This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Just in Time by Marie Bostwick. This book is read by Emily Sutton Smith, Kate Marson, and Carol Monda. For my sister Donna, who has the tenacity of a terrier, the loyalty of a lab, and the caring heart of a cavalier. Prologue. Grace. For a long time now, my conversations with Jamie have been imaginary. That doesn't stop me from having them. When I first met Nan and Monica and told him about the bizarre circumstances of our connection, Jamie didn't laugh, but he wanted to. I could tell from the way he worked to suppress his smile and how his blue eyes somehow looked bluer under the disbelieving arc of his brows, the way they do when he thinks I've done something ridiculous but adorable. Wait. Let me make sure I'm getting this right. Your support group is made up of support group dropouts? He asked. Except he didn't say that. He didn't say anything. Imagination has served me well, always, but it has its limitations. Or maybe we do. I do. Either way, there comes a point when you want something more concrete, a record and a response, a declaration of fact, or what you believe the facts to be. I realize there's no narrator as unreliable as one who tells his own story. But who else have we got? Carl Sagan, the American cosmologist, once said, "We are made of star stuff." I've always liked that quote. Jamie did too. It's such a pretty notion. But as I sit here, perched on top of this rock in this treeless and windswept spot that isn't really close to the top of the world, but feels like it could be, my lungs working to glean enough oxygen for existence, and look out across the vista of gray and green and granite to a spot on the horizon that might be the end of the world or the beginning, I understand in a way I never have before the limits of imagination and everything else. Only a thin sliver of sunlight has disappeared beneath the horizon, just a small and succulent slice from the bottom of the melon, but already its absence has brought a chill to the air. Soon, this day will end. Night will resume its rightful place and purpose, giving rest to the earth, revealing the stars. They will be beautiful this high up, so far from the lights of the city, the influence and evidence of civilization. It's strange, don't you think, that the only way for humans to truly see the stars is at a remove from the rest of humanity? That signifies something, I think. But at the moment, I'm not exactly sure what. I'm cold and getting colder, consumed by the knowledge that the stars, while breathtakingly beautiful, are silent. They shine brightly, but do not speak. We are star stuff. But more, I think. We are what we've done, and said and thought and ignored. We are who we have loved and championed, who we have failed and forgotten, and who we have forgiven. We are what we have believed, and what we have refused to believe. We are star stuff, but more. We are words and action, moment and place, doubts and faith, and story. This is mine. I'd like to tell Jamie. I can't. So I'm telling you. I'm telling myself. Chapter 1. Grace. One night after work, just a few months after I moved to Portland, I went into the bistro near my office for a bite to eat. I was sitting at the bar because it felt less conspicuous. The bartender and I struck up a conversation, and a few minutes into it, he handed me a flyer for a grief support group. Apparently, he kept it and a supply of similarly helpful publications stowed next to the highball glasses. "Bartenders and social workers have a lot in common," he said. I've never been a joiner. The idea of sharing my problems with a room full of strangers made my pulse race and my hands feel clammy. But I knew I couldn't go on like I had been. I mean, if a bartender can peg your problems after one glass of crummy house Chardonnay and 10 minutes of awkward conversation, so can everybody else. And maybe I wouldn't have to talk. Maybe I could just listen. It couldn't hurt to try, right? But when I got to the community center, I knew it wasn't going to work. The members of the group were all women, all widows. Definitely not a club I was interested in joining. And apart from two people, including a woman with frizzy brown hair that kept falling into her eyes and who kept twitching and fidgeting in her seat as if she was having a hard time sitting still, 70 was a fond but distant memory in the minds of the other participants. The room was filled by the sounds of sniffling, and the odor of white diamonds perfume was so strong it almost made my eyes water. The other woman I couldn't help but notice was older, but somehow not. The kind of woman who seems comfortable with her age and herself at any age. Her shoulder-length hair was a halo of curls around her head, a sandy blonde color interspersed with threads of silver white. Her eyes were big and brown, and her gaze was very direct. Something about that made me feel like she saw things other people missed. Her clothes intrigued me, too. I've always appreciated people who have a unique sense of style. I'd seen her blue and white skirt on sale recently, but I was pretty sure that her denim jacket, embroidered with birds and flowers, was done by hand. The fact that she'd paired it with red sneakers made me think she had a good sense of humor and didn't take herself too seriously. She seemed to be with the group, smiling warmly at many of the white-haired women, but not of it. She quietly made the rounds with her dog, a tail-thumping golden retriever who rested her muzzle in the laps of weeping participants, gazing intently until they started to stroke her silky head, smile wetly, and calm down, at which point she would move on to a new, more distraught participant. Still, there was a lot of crying going on, and it made me uncomfortable. During the bathroom break, I got up and quietly left. I was standing in the parking lot, about to unlock my car, when I heard a voice. "Sneaking off?" The woman with the frizzy hair was leaning against the hood of the red PT Cruiser parked next to me. Even though she was wearing a pair of thick-heeled clogs, shoes designed for comfort rather than fashion, she stood only a couple of inches over 5 feet. But somehow she seemed taller, partly because of her voice, big and brassy, but also because of her face. She had one of the most expressive faces I'd ever seen. Every thought or opinion she had was telegraphed through her eyes, lips, nose, cheeks, and especially her eyebrows, dark brown and bristling, capable of moving in ways I'd never seen eyebrows move before. I remember thinking that in the days of silent films, she'd have been a star. She pulled a pack of cigarettes from her purse. "It's not the right group for me," I said, answering her question. She didn't say anything, just lit her cigarette and stared at me. "I'm not a widow," I explained.
"I am, but it's not the right group for me either."
She took a long draw, making the cigarette tip glow orange and puffing out her cheeks. It didn't look like she was inhaling.
"It's a grief support group, which is fine, but I'm not feeling particularly grieved. Pissed off, but not grieved. You'd think that in the whole city of Portland, there'd be at least one support group for the pissed-off widows of cheating husbands. I mean, I can't be the only one, right?"
She blew out a long column of smoke and looked me up and down, eyebrows twitching and working, assessing me as if I were a dress she was thinking about trying on.
"You're not pissed off, are you?"
She frowned.
"No, you're sad. Really sad. I'm sorry."
Portland is not like the small town in Minnesota where I grew up. It's a city that takes pride in diversity and keeping Portland weird. So this was far from the first strange conversation I'd had since coming here. 2 days before, a homeless woman who had recently taken up residence between two concrete planters a block from my apartment stopped me as I was getting into my car and asked, politely, but with the same kind of grave intensity you might use to ask someone if they believed in life after death, if I had a Twinkie in my purse. A week before that, a man with pupils as big and shiny as black marbles, wearing a tattered blue beach towel draped around his shoulders, like the cape of a superhero who had escaped a methadone clinic, clutched my sleeve to ask if I was human or android. For a girl who grew up in rural Minnesota, those kinds of exchanges were unnerving, but I was starting to get used to them. But those people had been glassy-eyed,
high as kites, and so they were easier to dismiss. This conversation was somehow more disturbing because the woman was both sober as a saint and weirdly insightful. She took another pull on her cigarette. This time she deliberately drew the smoke into her lungs. Instantly her face turned red and she started hacking so hard her eyes watered.
Are you okay?
She didn't look okay. Should I pound her on the back? Call 911?
I hate these things, she rasped after she finally quit coughing.
I've been trying to learn to smoke, but it just isn't working out.
Really?
Apart from the addle-brained adolescents trying to impress their friends, who wants to take up smoking?
I know, she sighed, rightly reading my expression. But every day I wake up feeling like I want to punch somebody in the face. The Paxil my doctor prescribed made me gain weight. I thought cigarettes would be better.
She flicked the cigarette from her fingers and ground it out under her shoe.
This was a stupid idea.
As I stood there, trying to figure out if I should say something besides, well, okay then, good night, crazy lady, I heard the chirp of a keyless car remote. The taillights of an SUV in the next row flashed. The woman with the red sneakers and embroidered jacket was walking toward us. Her dog, now leashless, padded alongside her.
Smoke break? Or did you just have enough? She thrust out her hand.
I'm Nan Wilder. This is Blixen.
The retriever thumped her tail against my fender and looked up as if to say hello, her tongue lolling out of her mouth.
Grace Saunders, I said, taking her hand.
The lady with the frizzy hair pushed it out of her eyes and reached down to scratch Blixen's ear.
I'm Monica Romano.
What were you two doing in there? Nan asked.
Pilates meets in the same room on Tuesdays. I thought maybe you got the nights mixed up. Or you got lost.
I saw a flyer pinned to the bulletin board at the drugstore and I thought, you know, maybe I'd give it a shot.
Monica ducked her head, looking a bit sheepish.
It wasn't what I thought it would be. Maybe I should try a drum circle?
Nan murmured, which is what I later learned she did when she disagreed but was trying to be supportive. Nan says, a lot.
I heard you say something about being angry, Nan said.
But not grieving?
Not at all.
Monica fumbled with the flap on her purse, as if she was thinking about getting another cigarette.
My husband was killed in a boating accident 8 months ago. His girlfriend was driving the boat.
Ouch, Nan winced. I'd be mad, too.
And you?
She turned toward me.
Were you lost, or did you show up on purpose?
On purpose, I guess. But it's not the group for me. I'm not a widow.
But you are grieving.
The way Nan said it, as a statement instead of a question, and so directly, got me off guard. The same way that Monica's comment about me being sad had done. What was it about this place? Were people in Portland just unusually perceptive? Or had my expression become unusually transparent?
It's complicated.
It's complicated is shorthand for I don't want to talk about this. Most people get that and will either leave it there, change the subject, or remember they're late for an appointment. Not Nan.
Grief comes in all kinds of forms, doesn't it? Blixen and I have had quite a bit of experience there. She's a therapy dog. We visit hospitals, nursing homes, that kind of thing.
I'm a widow. My husband was killed in a private plane crash 20 years ago. The facilitator called me because she's worried that some of these women have been with her for years and aren't making any progress. She thought Blixen might be able to comfort some of them.
She looked down at the dog, returning her adoring gaze.
Well, I think she did, I said,
and patted the dog on the head. Nan looked up with a brilliant smile, her face glowing like a proud mother whose child has just received an enormous compliment.
Would you two like to come over to my house for a cup of tea? She asked, then quickly added,
I know, it's sudden, and I'm a stranger. I could be crazy, a complete nut job. But trust me, I'm not.
Not very.
She smiled.
I just thought that, well, you're looking for somebody to talk to. I'm a good listener.
You don't fit in with this bunch, she said, tilting her head toward illuminated windows of the big community room where the white-haired circle was still in session.
But I have a feeling you might have a tough time finding a place where you do belong. Neither of you quite fits the mold, do you?
I'm running a little short of human companionship myself these days. Blixen has many fine qualities, but she's not the world's best conversationalist.
Maybe we can be our own support group?
I didn't know what to say. Yes, she seemed nice, a caring, insightful, and possibly quite wise woman who liked to help. But how did I know? Denials aside, Nan could have been crazy. And if she wasn't, maybe Monica was. The signs certainly pointed in that direction.
Gee, I said slowly. That's nice of you, but...
I have peach turnovers, Nan said, and homemade vanilla ice cream. Monica's hand shot up. Yes, please, she turned to me. You in?
I knew I should say no. Even if they weren't crazy, they were definitely weird, not like anybody I knew back home. But I wasn't back home. I didn't have any friends in Portland. Not one.
The turnovers are homemade too, Nan said, adding an extra incentive. Fresh baked this morning. My stomach growled, making my mind up for me, as it so often does.
Is it far? I don't know my way around very well yet.
Even if you did, you'd never find it, Nan laughed. But you can follow me. I'll drive slow.
And I did. I got in my car and followed Nan home, which is so unlike me. But that night I forgot to be cautious, sensible, or shy. And it saved me.
I mean it. It saved me. They saved me.
Who could have imagined? Not me. Not then.
But the thing is, sometimes you don't know you're going down for the third time until somebody pulls you into the boat.
Chapter 2. Grace. When I was 7, my Grammy taught me to sew. She'd grown up on a farm and never liked to waste anything, so every winter she'd gather up the family's worn-out clothes to make quilts. Every fall, she'd enter a quilt in the country fair and win a prize. My mother, who couldn't shop the sale rack because she didn't want to buy something that everybody else had passed over, made fun of Grammy's quilts, saying it was just one more way for her mother to be cheap. As if making me wear a dress handed down through 3 sisters wasn't enough, now she expects me to sleep under it, too. I thought Grammy's quilts were wonderful. Always the quiet one, and often overlooked in a family of boisterous brothers, I reveled in the attention and praise she lavished upon me during our sewing sessions. I also loved the stories she'd tell about each block. Now, this pale blue was from the shirt your grampy wore when he came over to my house to propose. My dad knew why Ted was there. He stood on the porch and said I wasn't home, but I hollered from upstairs, "Oh, yes, I am," then ran downstairs, took the bouquet Ted brought for me, and said I'd marry him. That's why I picked the lily corner block for this one, because that's the kind of flowers he brought me. When I was 9, Grammy helped me make a log cabin quilt. I entered it in the fair and won $10 and a ribbon, the only prize I'd ever won in my life. Grammy died the following year, but the things she taught me stuck with me. I was always making something. Doll clothes, pin cushions, crocheted pot holders. My mother never thought much of my crafty inclinations or my tendency to hide inside of books. Making things made me feel like there was at least one thing I knew how to do that other people couldn't. In high school, I started sewing my own clothes, dark, shapeless outfits that were designed to make me blend into the background, because nothing in the juniors department fit me. Even after I lost weight, I still had plenty of curves, so I continued to make my own fit and flare fashions, dresses with fitted waists and full skirts, partly because they flattered my figure, but mostly because it finally gave me a chance to indulge my love of color.
Most every dress I sewed was made from material I found on the discount rack of the fabric store. The brighter, the better. My twirly skirts, Jamie called them, because the minute I put one on, I couldn't help but spin around in a circle, making the hem flutter around my thighs, feeling pretty and feminine and incandescently happy. I haven't been doing a lot of twirling recently. Portland's housing market is tight. If you find something you can afford in the location you want, you have to be ready to go. We put our stuff in storage and rented a tiny studio for 3 months before we finally closed on the condo, purchased after looking at pictures the realtor emailed to us. A year and a half later, the place still looked a lot like it did when we moved in, with boxes of books shoved in the corner and unhung paintings piled against the wall. It wasn't important. By then I had bigger problems to worry about than decorating. But I wished I'd paid more attention to closet space before buying. There was only one. Initially, I hung up Jamie's clothes along with my own. I considered it an act of faith. But after a few months, I accepted reality. Jamie was not ever going to live here. I boxed up his things to make space for my work clothes and stacked them with the books. They sat there for weeks. After tripping over one and breaking a toe during a middle-of-the-night trip to the bathroom, I realized I had to do something. I started sorting through Jamie's things and cutting up the special items to make into quilt blocks, sewing them by hand. It's slow work, but it keeps me busy and gave me a chance to think, or, depending on the day, not to think. The longer I was at Hewlett and Hanson, where I worked as an administrative assistant for 4 commercial realtors, and where the atmosphere was as gray as the dress code, the less space there was for my twirly skirts. Sometimes it felt like the gray was trying to swallow up the bright colors of my old life. But the job had benefits and paid the bills, so I wasn't complaining. And that night, for the first time in forever, I had a reason to dress up. After trying on and rejecting 6 dresses, I settled on a vintage-style swing dress with a pink bolero sweater that matched the pink flamingo print. It had a kind of 1950s rockabilly Florida trailer park vibe, but who cared? I wasn't trying to impress anybody. I was only the third wheel in this menage, as I explained to Nan when the phone rang. "You're tagging along on Monica's date?" Monica is what, 42? Isn't she a little old for a chaperone? She's nervous, I said, foraging through the bathroom drawer for an eyebrow pencil. She hasn't been on a date in years. I'm only going along for moral support. And the food. We're going to the fish house, I exclaimed, unable to disguise my enthusiasm. Well, la-di-da. Who is he? Tech entrepreneur? Stock broker? Think he'd like to make a donation to the pet rescue? Doubtful. He's some kind of carpenter, makes tables, and Monica is paying for dinner. Well, not paying, exactly. I leaned closer to the bathroom mirror and filled in my brows. Monica knows the manager at the fish house, and he gave her gift cards, some kind of industry courtesy, but she has to use them right away. But why would this... Luke, I said, filling the blank for her. Luke Pauling? Patterson? Something with a P. I can't remember. But why would this Luke want to go on a date with 2 women? Well, I don't think he thinks it's a date. More like a sales call. Monica wants new tables and banquettes for the restaurant, and Luke came over to bid on the job. I was only there because Monica asked if I could pick Alex up from cross-country practice and then drop him off at the restaurant. When I got there, Monica said she'd like to see Luke's portfolio, then suddenly remembered about the gift cards she needed to use and suggested the 3 of us get together over dinner to discuss the project. Oh, doesn't that seem a little devious? Well, yes, but I almost can't blame her. He's really handsome. And it's time Monica started getting out there. I think she'd be a lot happier if she had a boyfriend. Okay. But why did she have to involve you? It's bound to be awkward. It's all right. I'm used to Monica roping me into things. Last week she talked me into coming to Alex's school for a program on the college application process. Already? Nan clucked.
Alex is only 15. They put too much pressure on kids. But why did you have to go to a meeting about helping Alex get into college?
Because, I said, exchanging the eye pencil for a lip pencil, the forecast was calling for rain, which meant that the barometer was going to drop, which meant that Monica would be getting a migraine just as the meeting was set to start. She begged me to come along and take notes so she wouldn't miss anything. She's panicked about Alex not getting into college, staying in Portland, and making her life even more miserable than it already is.
You don't get a headache because it rains, Nan said. If that was true, the entire population of Portland, Oregon would have a headache 9 months out of 12.
I know, I said, twisting a lipstick tube open. I wish Monica would stay off WebMD. In the last 6 months, she's diagnosed herself with shingles, gallstones, plantar fasciitis, anemia, psoriasis, and Lyme disease. But really, I think she just wanted me to come along to serve as a buffer between her and Alex.
Monica does that sometimes, uses me as a human shield between herself and her stepkids, Alex and Zoe. Alex is pretty rotten to her, no matter what, but he isn't quite as rotten when I'm around.
The whole dinner for three thing does feel weird, I admitted, after blotting my lipstick on a tissue. Even for Monica. Luke seemed pretty surprised by the invitation, but he's just getting his business off the ground, so maybe he's anxious to land a client. Or maybe he totally has Monica's number, realizes she's nervous about dating and being the one to ask him out first, and is going along with it just so she won't feel embarrassed. My money's on that. He seemed too smart to fall for Monica's ruse. Or maybe he's like me, in it for the food. I'm not going to turn down free oysters.
This Luke, he's Italian?
I don't know what he is, but definitely not Italian, I said, recalling Luke's handsome face. Tanned, but not swarthy, his wavy, sand-colored hair, and beautiful brown-gold eyes.
Huh. Weird that I couldn't remember his last name, but recalled his face in such detail.
Those eyes. But what struck me most was not the unusual color of his eyes, but the intensity of his gaze. When Monica spoke, he really listened. Not too many men know how to do that. I'd only ever known one.
Not Italian, but I thought Monica was only...
A dog started to whine in the background. The noise was too high-pitched for Blixen, and Blixen never whines.
New resident? I asked.
He just came yesterday. Misses his mommy terribly, poor boy.
I know, Nelson, I know, Nan said in a low, soothing voice. It's all right to be sad, baby.
In addition to her many other good works, Nan volunteers with Rainbow Gate, a pet rescue providing foster care to dogs whose owners have died. Nan may be the kindest person I've ever met. She raised 7 kids, 4 biological and 3 adopted, all grown now, and is the reason the term Earth Mother exists. Nan knits, crochets, tats, and sews. Like me, she loves anything involving fiber. That alone would have drawn me to her, but she also grows things, tomatoes, flowers, and herbs. She bakes, she cans things, she makes chairs out of bent branches, she raises chickens, for eggs, not meat. Nan's a vegetarian. She lives simply but deeply, and values people above possessions. That's why she refuses to carry a cell phone, because she says that being available to everyone at every moment makes it impossible to truly be there for the people who count when they really need you. Nan isn't like anyone I've ever known. She's part hip and part homespun, motherly and mysterious all at once. And beautiful. Not just for her age, but beautiful, with that glorious crown of curls and eyes that have seen everything, good and bad, and still keep smiling, enthused about whatever comes next. She's an old soul with a young heart and might be the only real grown-up I've ever met.
Nelson is a beautiful little schnauzer, she said. 3 years old, perfectly behaved, handsome as they come. He'd make a wonderful brother for Maisie.
No, I said firmly, because when it came to Nan and dogs, you have to.
Nan has found the perfect dog for me about once a month since we met, though I would never have pictured myself with a Chihuahua. In Macy's case, she was right. Nelson might have been perfect too, but my building only allowed one dog per condo, as I explained to Nan yet again.
But Macy is so tiny, she protested.
No, there's no room in my life for an emotionally needy schnauzer, I said, as Nelson began whining again. Listen to him. He'd be miserable left alone all day.
I suppose you're right, Nan sighed.
Nelson's pathetic whine became even more pathetic, the canine equivalent of keening.
Oh, dear. Oh, this poor baby. Grace, I have to go. I'll see you Monday.
I said goodbye and finished putting on my makeup, my mouth watering as I thought about dinner. I planned to dive face first into a platter of just shucked oysters, then follow it up with crab cakes, then lobster claws, then start all over with oysters again. Just thinking about it made me dizzy. But the fact that I hadn't eaten anything all day might have had something to do with it. I was saving room. Tonight, for once, I didn't want to feel guilty about calories or anything else. I slipped my feet into a pair of heels and checked the time, momentarily forgetting that my watch was broken. Seeing the hands frozen at 2:18 past, I felt a catch in my throat.
Stop. It's too late to back out. You're going to have a good time tonight. You are. It's not like you're doing anything wrong.
I took a deep breath to collect myself, swallowing back the wave of guilt, and then reached for my earrings. As I did, I heard a ping, the sound of something dropping onto the counter. I looked at my left hand and saw an empty setting where a diamond should have been. My ring. Jamie sold his motorcycle to buy that diamond. Panic, I dropped to my hands and knees. After 5 heart-pounding minutes of frantic searching, I found the stone hiding in the threads of my fuzzy white bath mat. It must have bounced off the counter. I sat back, legs crossed underneath my skirt, and took a deep breath, trying to collect myself and swallow the wave of guilt and doubt. Maybe it was a sign. Maybe I shouldn't go. But I couldn't back out on Monica, not at the last minute. I climbed to my feet, smoothed out my skirt, then put my ring and the loose diamond in my jewelry box before running out the door. I was so late and so frazzled, and I couldn't remember Luke's last name. What would I say when the hostess asked for the name of my party?
Stop. Seriously, stop. You're getting worked up over nothing. If you have to, you can go into the dining room and look for him. You'll remember Luke once you see him. And even if you don't, Monica will be there already, so you can just look for her. Say what you want about Monica. At least she's never late.
Chapter 3. Monica. When Luc Pascal showed up at my restaurant to give me a bid for new tables and banquettes, I got so flustered that I asked what kind of wood he worked with twice, only realizing I'd done it when he tipped his head to one side and slowly said,
"Well, as I said before..."
"Sorry," I replied. "My stepson plays his music so loud, I think I must be going a little deaf." I laughed self-consciously and forced myself to quit staring. But really, it was hard not to. His eyes were the same rich golden brown as the beef and bone broth I make by the gallon for the restaurant. His physique caught my attention as well. Tall and lean, athletic-looking but not muscle-bound, which I now consider a plus. Vince used to spend hours at the gym. At least, that's where he said he was. It's just as possible he was out bench-pressing blondes. But he was definitely a Muscle Beach type. Big biceps, thick neck, even thicker skull. I've sworn off gym rats for life. Luke was absolutely nothing like my late, hideous husband, not in manner, temperament, or looks. My first impression of him was that he was polite, capable, and smart, and undeniably attractive. But he wasn't my type. I don't know why, but the men who melt my butter are always Italian. Always. Which is weird, because my maiden name is Schiller, and my roots are German, Polish, and Lutheran. Yet the men who make my heart go pitter-pat have names that end with vowels and marinara sauce running through their veins. It makes no sense, but it is what it is. And I have to tell you, my track record is not good. In high school, Johnny Zeffirelli cheated on me with my best friend and stood me up on prom night. In chef school, Anthony Esposito broke my heart, stole my recipe for bucatini alla Sorrentina, and became valedictorian because of it. Then there was Rob Russo, Joe Ricci, Matt Costa, and, of course, the infamous Vincente Romano. You get the idea. After Vince and his bimbo du jour downed 4 bottles of Barolo and rammed our boat into a piling, she survived. Her most obvious attributes turned out to be excellent flotation devices. I decided to swear off Italian men forever, which was essentially saying I was swearing off men forever. All men, forever. And hey, why not? I'm 42. I'm over it. I've already done it all. The lust thing, the boyfriend thing, the husband thing, the mother thing. Okay, technically it's the stepmother thing, but still, I'm over it. Big time. My stepkids are rotten. I know, I'm not supposed to say that. They're just kids and they've been through a lot. First their mom runs off with some guy who was demonstrating juicers at the fair and is never seen or heard from again. Then their dad dies in a boating accident with his mistress. I get it. But before you go judging me, remember that I'm the one who has stuck by them, fed them, clothed them, and contributed to their college funds, even though they're rotten kids and I was only married to their father for 2 years. To be fair, Zoe isn't completely rotten. She's whiny, for sure, and mouthy, and a real drama queen. But so was I at 13, so maybe this is payback. She does seem to be entering a slutty phase that has me worried, but I still couldn't call her completely rotten. But Alex is. Definitely. For example, his schoolwork. I've been Alex's stepmother for 3 years. Since then, I've shown up for every parent-teacher conference, something Vince never bothered to attend, which translates to separate, private meetings with 30 teachers. I'm not even including the times I've been called to the principal's office because he's done some knucklehead thing or other. In all those meetings, I can't remember a single teacher saying anything about Alex except that he wasn't living up to his potential, and then looking at me like it was my fault and I was supposed to fix it. Look, I would if I could. Alex is smart, I realize that, and he's totally wasting his talent. But what do they want from me? I came into mothering late in the game and with zero training. If kids were like recipes and came with detailed instructions, I'd know what to do. As it is. Grace says I shouldn't let Alex and Zoe push my buttons. I try, I really do. But can I help it if they know exactly where all my buttons are? Alex especially. He's like my brother Stevie, the brilliant and favored one. Stevie was smart too, like Alex, and way more competitive. Why he felt the need to compete with me, I'll never understand. It's not like he wasn't already getting all of my parents' attention. Even so, he put me down whenever he got a chance. And my parents never stood up for me, ever. When I was little, Stevie could torment me until I sobbed, and the most my mother would say was, "Now, Stevie." One day, when I was 9, Stevie called me a name and waited for me to cry. I didn't. Instead, in the sweetest voice possible, I asked if he'd noticed how that new automatic toilet cleaner Mom bought turned the water blue, and how, after somebody used the bowl, the water was the exact same yellow-green as his eyes. He went off howling, searching for my mother, who made me do dishes for a week. But it was worth it. I had discovered Stevie's weakness and my weapon. My brother was smart, but not quick. I'm just the opposite. Quick, but not smart. Sarcasm worked for me, and I got better at it as time went on. And now? It's gotten to be a habit, especially if I'm feeling defensive. When it comes to dealing with Alex, I'm always playing defense. Okay, I'm getting off track here. Sorry, I do that sometimes. The point is, when Vince died, I decided I was over it. Over Italians, over men, over motherhood, over all of it. But lately, I don't know. My grandmother ate herring and sour cream and kielbasa every day of her life and lived to be 97. Do I really want to be alone for the next 55 years? I've had a run of incredibly bad luck, no doubt about it. But what if I was pickier? What if I refused to settle for anything less than the perfect man? Somebody with no secrets, no flaws. I'm not saying that such a man exists, but if he did, I'd be crazy to pass him up, right? At first glance, Luke seemed to have perfect potential. Like I said, he is polite, capable, smart, handsome, and a good listener. And really passionate about his work. I could tell by the way he explained about the different decorative options for pedestal supports, options that were probably beyond my budget. All I really needed and could afford is a carpenter who could knock together a few nice tables and some benches, but Luke is obviously a real craftsman. "Where did you learn all this?" I asked. "I picked up my basic carpentry skills from my grandpa. He had a woodworking shop in his basement. When I was a kid, I spent all my time hanging out with him. And I put myself through college and law school doing construction for a big tract home building company in the summers. After a few years, I figured out I hated being a lawyer, so I chucked it. After a couple of detours, I finally sold everything and went to France. I was there for 3 years, studying under a master furniture maker. I came back to the States 2 months ago to start my own custom furniture business." He is adventurous, an entrepreneur, no stranger to hard work, and he loved his grandpa. How sweet is that? And though he only looked to be about 35, he'd already gotten through his midlife crisis and figured out what mattered in life. Impressive. I glanced at Luke's left hand, noting neither wedding ring nor the telltale tan line of a married man who likes to cheat. After my Matt Costa debacle, I always looked for the tan line. So he is single, too. The more we talked, the more perfect Luke Pascal appeared to be. But still, not Italian. I closed my eyes and tried to imagine him as Luigi Pasquale. "Monica, are you all right?" I opened my eyes. No good. He was still blonde, and not only was my butter not melting, it was cold enough to make pie crust. "Oh, yes, I was just, trying to picture those carved apron supports you were describing." Dang, you can't start a fire without a spark. But a guy this good really shouldn't go to waste. When Grace arrived with Alex in tow, it occurred to me that maybe he didn't have to. "Hey, Grace, do you have a second? Come over here. I need help figuring out what kind of tables to order for the restaurant." I knew Grace was in a hurry and that she was already doing me a favor by dropping Alex off after practice, but I also knew she had a hard time saying no. Grace is a good person and unfailingly polite, a product of her Midwestern upbringing. Unfailing politeness is not something I suffer from. Normally, I try not to take advantage of Grace's particular weakness, but since I was acting with her future happiness in mind, I figured it was okay. After taking a moment to glare at me as he passed, Alex slumped down in an empty booth and started messing with his phone. He spends so much time on the phone that sometimes I feel like it's been surgically attached to his hand. But when he's texting with friends, at least he's not arguing with me. Grace sat down at our table. Her polite but pained smile told me that she really needed to go, but I pretended not to notice. Potentially perfect men don't just walk in off the street every day, you know. I wasn't 100% convinced that Luke and Grace would be a good match, not yet. But if my instincts turned out to be right, an extra 5 minutes of her time was a small price to pay. She'd thank me later. "Luke is new to Portland," I said after completing the introductions. Grace was distracted, her eyes a little glazed, probably thinking about all the things she should be doing besides helping me pick out furniture. I gave her a subtle nudge under the table and a pointed look, signaling that I needed her to focus. A bit startled, she looked at me, then Luke, and smiled. Oh, really? She said, sounding so vague that I wasn't sure she'd actually heard my comment.
Not completely new, Luke said. A returned former resident. Things have sure changed since I left, especially the housing market. It's completely crazy. The asking price for my little bungalow in the Hollywood District with a workshop garage for my business was so outrageous that I asked the realtor if she was quoting me dollars or yen. The joke wasn't bad, just okay, but I gave him a couple of extra points for trying. So many guys have zero sense of humor. Cough, cough, Rob Russo. But the thing that put Luke over the top was his grin. When he smiled, his eyes crinkled at the corners, and his lips bowed, exposing a little chip at the bottom of one of his upper teeth, kind of a snaggletooth. Totally adorable. I was right. He was perfect for Grace. Grace, I knew, would disagree. Ryan Reynolds could have walked in the room with a dozen roses and an indecent proposal, and she still wouldn't have budged. For all her inability to say no, Grace is incredibly stubborn on this subject. But it was high time for her to find some happiness. As her friend, it was my job to help her whether she wanted my help or not. She'd thank me later. Or not. Either way, I had to come up with a plan to get these two together. But how? Look, Luke said, his expression suddenly serious. I'm going to be straight with you. I'm trying to get my business going, so I really need this job. I know you're not really in the market for fine furniture. You just want something good-looking and sturdy that will do the job. But I'm willing to work with you, make you some real quality pieces at a price that'll fit your budget. I do good work, Monica, and I've trained with the best. But you don't have to take my word for it. If you'd come out to my workshop, I could show you. Bingo. There it was. Luke didn't know it, but he just teed up the ball for me. Now all I had to do was take a swing and follow through. You know, that's a good idea. I would like to see some of your work. Do you have a portfolio? Luke nodded. Sure, I've got a book with pictures of all the pieces I made when I was in France. I meant to bring it with me, but... Great, I interrupted. But instead of going to your workshop... I made it up as I went. The food show I never attended, the restaurant gift cards I never received, the industry courtesy that didn't exist. Luke wanted this job badly, so I knew he'd agree to anything I proposed. Grace, I was less sure of. Besides being too polite for her own good, Grace has a couple of other weaknesses. Number one, she is loyal to a fault, will do anything for a friend. Number two, she loves to eat. I mean, really loves to eat. And for Grace's own good, I was willing to exploit those weaknesses. She'd thank me later. Really, Luke, you'd be doing me a favor. Those gift cards expire at the end of the week. It'd be a shame to let them go to waste. So if you don't mind coming downtown and bringing your portfolio, the three of us can meet at the restaurant. The glazed look cleared from Grace's eyes. Wait, the three of us? I'll need your decorating advice. Grace let out a disbelieving laugh. You're kidding, right? You've seen my condo. It's one step up from a refugee camp. I turned to Luke. She's being modest. Grace has terrific taste. Monica, I don't... I placed my heel onto Grace's toe and pressed down, just hard enough so she'd get the message. If you can't back me up here, at least shut up and go with it. Grace clamped her lips shut. Then I played my trump card. I told her about the restaurant, the chef, the menu, and the oysters. By the time I was finished, she was practically salivating. I swear I could hear her stomach growl. Really? I never knew there were that many varieties of oysters. I've only ever had them once before. Too expensive and not exactly standard menu fare if you grow up in Minnesota. But they were so, so good. Okay, count me in. I looked at Luke. Sure, he said. Me too. Sounds like fun. Saturday?
I was about to tell him that would be fine when I remembered Grace. She knows I never go out on Saturday. I shook my head. The restaurant is always crazy on Saturday night. How about Sunday?
Sunday works.
Luke looked at Grace.
Is that good for you?
Well, I was going to clean out the lint trap on the dryer, but, you know, she shrugged. I guess I can reschedule. Grace is usually pretty shy around new people. The fact that she was trying to joke around, even if the joke was pretty lame, felt like a good sign.
What a relief, Luke said with a smile, showing off his snaggle tooth.
That felt like another good sign. In fact, I was feeling very good about life in general. That is, until Alex put down his phone and pulled out his earbuds.
Hey, he said in his usual sarcastic snarl. You want to wrap it up here? Zoe texted me. Desmond got into the lasagna and is yakking all over the carpet.
I closed my eyes and pinched the bridge of my nose. The headache I'd been predicting ever since reading last week's weather forecast had finally arrived. I hate my life. When I opened my eyes and saw Luke staring at me, I said, Zoe is my stepdaughter. Desmond is our dog, a Newfoundland. He weighs 140 pounds, has a delicate stomach, and no moral compass. Sorry to cut this short, but I have to go. I jumped up from the table, ticked off, and with my head pounding, and yelled toward the kitchen so that Ben, my sous chef, would know I'd be back before the dinner crowd showed up, then hissed something at Alex, who hissed something back, and walked toward the door. Grace fell into step behind me. Sorry, she said. I have to go, too.
Oh, sure, no problem, Luke said,
sounding accommodating but also a little confused by the abrupt exodus.
But should I mean, do you want me to...
Grace, always so polite, turned around to face him. Yes, absolutely. Meeting us at the restaurant will be perfect, she said, backing out the door. See you on Sunday, 6 o'clock.
It was devious, I admit it. So was what I did later, convincing Grace that I was interested in Luke but too nervous to go on a date alone.
And then, when she started to waver, texting her photos of dishes from the Fish House website that pretty much amounted to food porn. But it wasn't half as devious as what I was about to do. First, I called the Fish House and talked to Andrew, the manager, explaining what was going on, that there could be no check presented at the end of the meal, and that the bill, however large, should be charged to my credit card. Next, I started composing my text, solving the twinges of guilt by reminding myself that this was for Grace's own good, and that everything I was saying wasn't a total lie. I really did feel a headache coming on, and could tell already that it was going to be a doozy. A headache the size of a tumor. No, I thought, deleting the tumor reference. Grace always made fun of my ailments. But people did get tumors, didn't they? And weren't raging headaches one of the symptoms? My head was just killing me. I typed the words brain tumor and headache and symptoms into my phone. A bunch of pretty scary articles came up. The third one made up my mind for me. I was definitely going by urgent care after work. I attached the article, hit send, and sat there for a minute, imagining the look on Grace's face after she read my message. She'd thank me. Later.
Chapter 4. Grace. Luke was sitting alone and drinking a glass of red wine when I arrived. I am so sorry, I exclaimed. I had a jewelry emergency, and the traffic was a nightmare, and I couldn't find a parking spot. He pulled out my chair. Take a breath. Monica's not here yet. Do you want a drink? I ordered a glass of Chardonnay and sat down, feeling awful. He'd probably thought he'd been stood up, and by two women at the same time. In his shoes, I would have been mortified, certain that everybody was staring at me. But Luke didn't seem the least bit perturbed. Unless he was the only one who didn't know this was a date? No, not possible. Monica was so obvious. Luke had to know what was going on. A big brown scrapbook that I guessed was his portfolio was lying on one of the empty chairs, but that could have been a prop. It had to be. I didn't know Luke well, but he seemed too smart to be taken in by such an obvious ruse. He'd brought his portfolio just to play along to save Monica the embarrassment of having been the one to ask him out instead of the other way around. That was very sweet. He seemed like a nice man, and so handsome. Those beautiful eyes. What color were they? Amber? Luke caught me staring at him and smiled. I pretended to cough, putting the white linen napkin to my mouth to cover my embarrassment. Where was Monica? Luke took a sip of wine and gazed out of the restaurant's big glass window, overlooking Director Park.
It's more of a square than a park, but serves the same purpose. The ground is a herringbone of gray and white pavers, with trees planted around the border.
There's a fountain on one end for kids to splash in during the warm weather, and a big checkerboard on the other end, with knee-high plastic chess pieces left out for anyone who wants to play. If you look up, maybe 20 or 30 feet, you'll see an enormous glass canopy hovering over a bunch of metal tables and chairs where people can sit and picnic. When it gets dark, the glass glows with a continually changing and unpredictable pattern of lights. Blue, green, purple, pink, orange. It's eerie and beautiful. An urban aurora borealis.
Look at that. Luke pointed toward the fountain and a young couple bundled up in parkas, boots, scarves, and blue knit caps. They were dancing, or trying to. It didn't seem to be going very well, but they were smiling, shuffling like a pair of clumsy circus bears.
That's what I love about cities, Luke said, his beautiful eyes fixed on the dancers. You do what you do, even when other people are around, because you have to. You've got no choice but to get out there and rub elbows with humanity. You might not know everybody's name, but you can see what they do. And plot is character, right? People reveal themselves through actions. It's really kind of intimate, don't you think?
He looked at me as if he expected an answer. I never thought about it that way. He'd caught me off guard. Was this how people talked in France? Skipping the small talk and going directly into meaningful conversation? It was a little unnerving, but a part of me liked it. I've always sucked at small talk, and I could see he was right. The forced proximity of city life creates an unavoidable intimacy with others. You stand witness to the lives of your neighbors, whether you want to or not. I thought about the homeless couple with the mongrel dog who lived on the block next to mine. They had moved into the neighborhood not long after I did, their belongings piled into a child's red wagon. After choosing their spot, they laid out big sheets of cardboard between the two cement planters and spread their ragged sleeping bags on top, claiming the space as their own. Though the smell of weed hung on them from half a block away some days, they were quiet and kept their stuff from spreading out onto the sidewalk, so there was never a problem getting past. More than once I'd seen the girl pick up trash that other people dropped, load it into the red wagon, and cart it to the garbage can on the corner, like a vigilant housewife tidying up in case company came calling. I saw them almost every day of my life, yet I never spoke to them, partly because I felt like I might be intruding on their privacy, but mostly because I didn't know what to say. I thought, too, about the old man I saw in the grocery store the day before. He wore a dirty coat, had a long beard and bloodshot eyes. He stood in front of the coffee display with a red tin can in each hand and two more tucked under one arm. When he heard my cart coming down the aisle, he spun around and grinned at me.
2 for $5. I'm stocking up. Can't beat that price, can you?
I wheeled past him, avoiding eye contact. He seemed crazy, but would it have hurt to respond? Or at least smile? Luke, I suspected, would have stopped for a lengthy conversation. He obviously enjoyed talking to people, but I wasn't prepared for conversation. I was just supposed to be the chaperone. Where was Monica? The server arrived with my wine. I took a grateful sip, then reached for my bag, fumbling around inside, and pulled out my phone. Monica had sent me a text.
Can't make it. Dishwasher quit. Party of 10 showed up without a reservation. Also, feel awful. Another headache. Terrible. Going to urgent care on my way home.
I clicked on a link she attached, an article from one of the more disreputable health and fitness websites, and saw a panicked headline with 2 exclamation points about supposed links between cell phone use and brain tumors.
Tell Luke I'm sorry. Have fun. Don't be mad. More crab cakes for you.
She wasn't coming. She couldn't be serious. She couldn't really believe I was going to sit here with this stranger and calmly eat crab cakes, could she?
Monica,
I hissed, scanning the text again. I'm going to kill you. Then you won't have to worry about headaches anymore.